Mr. Schoengren?
Yes, sir.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Lawrence Schoengren. I represent a plaintiff class member, objector, and appellant, Pearl Martinez. The issues raised by appellant today are at the heart of the proper functioning of the class action mechanism. Issue number one, the reasonableness of the fees awarded to class counsel, more particularly in this case, the inadequacy of the district court's justification of a $4.25 million fee award, and secondly, the issue of the circumstances entitling a meritorious objector to an award of reasonable attorney's fees. Your Honor, as regards the fee to class counsel, the explanation is inadequate as a matter of law. The district court provided no reasoning by which this court can make a reasonable review of the fee awarded. And this kind of review is particularly important in the class action context. Why $4.25 million? Why not $3.25 million or $5.25 million? Why 15%? Why not 10% or 20%? The best class counsel can say is that 25% is a benchmark. But that's no reason why 15% presents a reasonable fee. Furthermore, the 15% benchmark comes from an entirely different fee jurisprudence than the fee jurisprudence that is used by this court. Indeed, the fee jurisprudence which established a 25% benchmark is a fee jurisprudence which has been specifically rejected by this court. I would also point out that even the benchmark 25% used by the Ninth Circuit has been criticized by Professor Coffey. The district court makes generalized references to risk, saying, for example, success was not a foregone conclusion. In terms of work, the court talked about the efforts in the case, but there's no analysis linking these conclusionary statements to specific conduct.
Now, is it correct that we don't know how many hours the plaintiffs, except for the Miller firm, how many hours the lawyers spent on the case?
As far as I know, that information was provided in camera, yes. More importantly, the court's characterization is part of an ex post facto analysis, which the unique jurisprudence of this court specifically has rejected in favor of an ex ante analysis, the market at the time of the undertaking of the representation, the filing of the complaint, and that's a crucial issue in this case, as you've talked about for so many hours this morning. There was a meeting that took place before a complaint was even filed, and apparently before even a client was obtained. So under this ex ante analysis, those certainly should be factors that go into what the market would be at the time the complaint was filed. Yet there's no such analysis. There's nothing in the opinion that talks about the kind of factors that this court requires to be considered by a district court in awarding a reasonable fee. With regard to fees to objectors, the adversarial representation is at the heart of the American justice system. In the class action context, objectors are the lifeblood of the adversary process. The objection raised by appellant Martinez and the ruling of the court confirmed the objection had merit. The court even said, I agree in part with the suggestion of objector Lawrence W. Schoengren, etc. The reason the court denied the fees, because the court said it had come to that, it had that same concern before the objections were filed.
How do you respond to the argument that even if objectors are entitled to compensation for altering the terms of the settlement, that the earliest and the principal objectors that were identified by Judge Sagal were the Carnegie attorneys, and therefore they'd be the only ones entitled to fees based on the settlement?
Well, I don't know that the Carnegie objectors raised the same issues that Pearl Martinez raised, but the judge in his opinion, specifically with respect to Martinez, said, I agree in part with the suggestion of objections raised by Lawrence W. Schonbrunn. He didn't refer to the Carnegie objectives, so he specifically on the record was relying in part on the objection that I raised. The issue boils down to whether undisclosed, undocumented, as the other objectors said, inherently unknowable concerns of a district court judge are going to be sufficient to deny a reasonable attorney's fee to a meritorious objector. I would say, number one, it is equitably unfair in the sense that the court sends out a notice, the court asks you to object, the court puts nothing in the notice about it, what its concerns are. You raise a meritorious objection, and the judge says, sorry, I thought about it, I thought about this before. Secondly, it is contrary to the public philosophy of the adversarial process. Courts are constantly lamenting about the fact that fees are an unadversarial process.
If all the objectors got fees, then the total amount of fees is going to be considerably more than 4.2 million.
I think that is a separate issue.
Is that a significant problem?
It is. It's not a significant problem. It is a concern. Certainly, the fees have to be reasonable. But that's a different issue, I think, than just arbitrarily saying, I thought of it. It makes it kind of a roulette game, it seems to me, and there should be a more orderly.
Well, you have to show, wouldn't you, that your efforts had increased the size of the pie.
Not in the...
Because otherwise, as Judge Cuddy said, your efforts would actually be subtracting from the amount that the class members got.
No, it wouldn't, because first of all, it wouldn't, because fees to objectors can be awarded from class counsel's fee, number one. Fees for an objector can, under the authority of the class action cases, be paid by the defendant, or they can be paid by the class, but it isn't necessarily true at all that the class's recovery will be reduced for an objection that doesn't change a term of the settlement or reduce a fee. The cases talk. I think I see my.
Thank you, Mr. Harris.
May it please the court, Daniel Harris, plaintiff class. The Bowdoin, Abercrombie, and Williams appeals should be dismissed based on this court's decision in Felton and the Supreme Court's decision in Marino. Bowdoin, Williams, and Abercrombie are not parties and may have not appealed the district court's decision denying their motions to intervene.
Why should they have to be parties for purposes of fee determination?
Well, I think that the rules of appellate jurisdiction require that it's parties who can file appeals. They could appeal, they could have moved to intervene for that limited purpose and sought, if it was denied.
What's the point? Is it just some more paper shuffling, or is there some practical benefit to requiring that they move to intervene?
I think it's similar to the reason this court employed recently in the Navigan consulting case, which I think would also explain why Martinez's motion was properly denied. There are certain rules that people have to go through to acquire to create appellate jurisdiction.
Well, it's just Felton here, though, isn't it? It doesn't involve the rules. It's just a Felton case.
Right.
They were heard, though, these people.
Yes.
But now lawyers, a lawyer who was, lawyer retained by a party in the case would make a motion for a fee, and if that motion was denied and didn't get the fee he wanted, he could certainly appeal, even though he's not a party to the litigation. So it's not true that only parties can appeal. So why is their situation any different?
Your Honor, rather than try and answer that more quickly than I should, why don't I move on to the other grounds where I think the decision should be done. I think on the merits, the fee applications were properly denied. None of these objectors conferred a benefit on the plaintiff class. As for...
they tried to. They say the $4 million is too much. I don't get this $4 million fee because, although this goes back to the original appeal, but The fee presumably is based on the incremental value conferred by the lawyers. If the defendant comes to people who don't have a suit and say, sue me and I'll give you $20 million.
That's not what happened.
Well, that's not quite what happened. But if that is what happened, then you wouldn't be entitled to base your $4 million fee on the $20 million part of the award. It would you'd have to show that you got that award up from the 20 to the 25.
Right, Your Honor. If I could back up and give a longer explanation of that, put the Metropolitan Club lunch in context based on the record. First off, to their credit, Mr. Prosnitz and Ms. Schwartz have been litigating RAL cases for a while. Okay? They had been engaged in this litigation for years prior to the Metropolitan Club lunch. The Metropolitan Club lunch was the same day of a, I believe it was a fairness hearing in the Jackson Hewitt settlement. So it was an arm's length, it was in the context of ongoing arm's length litigation. The testimony as to what happened at lunch is that somebody, Mr. Prosnitz or Mr. Schwartz, Ms. Schwartz, according to the district court opinion, said the case is worth over $100 million, to which there was a response that that's not realistic, that's crazy, you know, a real number, a real settlement number would have been 23 or 24, not that this was being offered. And as a matter of fact, at that meeting, Mr. Prosnitz made a proposal for an eight-figure class action settlement. And thereafter, he heard back from the defendant, and this is in the record, the answer is no. No counteroffer, nothing. So in the context of an ongoing litigation that had been going on, to their credit, for years before the Metropolitan Club meeting, they threw out a number. No, it's a crazy number, and even if it was, you know, this would be a realistic number, and even that, the answer is no. So, and if you look at what exactly happened, we didn't get back into it until we had Miller Forche on board. And then when I was approached to discuss settlement, I wouldn't discuss settlement until I got Miller Forche on board. And the initial offer was a 5% discount coupon. Block got involved. They started putting, they increased the cash, the value of the coupon. We finally, it was like pulling teeth. It took several months. It often happens in a long negotiation stretching over years. Somebody may say something, not early in the process, but somewhere in the process, that gives you a glimmer of what might be possible. Not that they say, this is what we're going to give you. Not what they have authority to give. Well, Rubin obviously didn't have authority to give it, and they didn't offer anything. They didn't offer anything, and they turned down the proposal when we made the proposal. We had to go back, get Miller Forche, and then spend years litigating it. Just because you have an insight at somewhere in the process of what might be possible, because a lawyer says something maybe indiscreetly or inadvertently, that's a crazy number, a realistic number would be this, and we're not going to give you that. And it was in the context we already had. Mr. Prosnitz and Mr. Schwartz had negotiated a settlement which was receiving judicial approval for $15 coupon. So we had a context, and we had years of raw litigation behind us. So I think to take the Metropolitan, to take a number that's thrown out there and say we started with that was wrong. That's not where we started. I think that the whole thing, Block and Beneficial winning these cases completely, you had a problem here that you had plaintiffs with theories of damages for billions of dollars. Now, in a normal real world, you don't try and settle a case for billions of dollars. If somebody throws out saying, I want you to disgorge all the money you ever made since the beginning of time, people don't say, well, all right, I'll give you 10% of that. No, they say, that's crazy, I'm not going to talk to you. We came back with a realistic damage theory based upon bait and switch for document preparation fees. They were willing to pay us more than 100 cents on a dollar for that, and an amount so that every class member who wants to file a claim is going to get more than their average provable damages. Now, I realize there are pie-in-the-sky numbers that if you take 10% of them, they're still pie-in-the-sky. And if the rule of law is you can't settle a case if some other lawyer can come up with a pie-in-the-sky number for $1 billion, that's going to be very hard to settle any cases. But in the real world, real plaintiffs give up pie-in-the-sky numbers for their actual out-of-pocket damages. If you look at how we measure damages,
there have been billion-dollar settlements.
Huh?
There have been billion-dollar settlements,
Your Honor. But in a case where the actual, not very often, to my knowledge, in Truthful Lending Act cases, you know, I mean, if you're dealing with a case where there's billions of dollars in out-of-pocket damages or billions of dollars in benefit of the bargain damages, but we didn't have any provable out-of-pocket damages. They improved their disclosures, so the price and market share went up. We had a benefit of the bargain damage theory, which is a stretch, which was $60 million according to Dr. Adler, just figuring what the doc prep fees were. But most of that was time barred. And then we had the disgorgement theory, which is pretty far-fetched. But, you know, I mean, it could have been a couple of billion dollars. It could have been several billion dollars. And I guess if the rule is we got to hold out to get 10 cents on a, you know, on all the revenue they ever made, I don't know if these cases are ever going to settle. I think we just have to litigate till we lose. But I don't think that's how plaintiffs normally do things. In the private market, private plaintiffs monitoring their clients, lawyers being monitored by clients. If they can get more than they actually lost, that's a pretty good deal. And what's what we got here? We got more than people actually lost.
Well, not the multiple people.
Yes, Your Honor, because the document preparation fees, the excluded stuff that's time barred, is $32 million. There are 17 million class members. That comes to $2 a customer. Now, the referral fee, the undisclosed referral fee, which is probably not an recoverable item of damage, was $6. So if you take the $2, we got people 15 or 30. That's pretty good, okay? And if you take the $6, 2 plus 6 is 8. We got from 15 or 30. It's still pretty good. Now, the problem here is that our real actual damages are so low. We've got these pie-in-the-sky theories, which are humongous. So how do you resolve a case like that? It's very hard to do with any exactitude. You can't apply a percentage to pie-in-the-sky numbers. Sometimes you have to take a realistic number in the middle. We had the Jackson-Jewett settlement, which was the product of years of litigation. And Francine Schwartz and Howard Krausman had been pushing these cases for years. And it was throwing out a number of hundreds of millions to get back a response. That's crazy. You know, maybe 23 or 24 would be a real number for you to throw out. And even if the answer is no, well, it may give you hope, you know. You might think that's a rejection. Somebody's just telling you no, get lost. But for a plaintiff lawyer who's used to taking no and getting beyond it, that's a hopeful sign. But I wouldn't say that we started out with any sure thing. They said no in 1997. They said no in 1998 when Howard Prosnitz and I made the proposal for the $215 discount coupons. When they finally put something on the table, it was a 5% discount coupon. It was like pulling teeth, trying to get them to come up. I think that what we did here was remarkable when you compare it to the history of failure that preceded it. Now I realize that hope springs eternal. And people can always say, I will do better the next time things are going to turn around. And if that's the answer, as long as there's somebody out there willing to take another shot at them for the $5 billion sure thing, it's going to be hard to settle. But a rational plaintiff, a reasonable plaintiff, will take his out-of-pocket losses, or more than them, or his benefits of bargain damages, and give up the pie-in-the-sky speculative claims. And that's what happened here. Now, in terms of these objectors, and the Carnegie and Apatow had already opposed the reversion. These guys didn't add anything. They think they should get paid just for participating in the process. And I think that's inconsistent with the common fund rule and inconsistent with...
But the settlement provided for a reversion.
It did.
So why wouldn't it be reasonable for them to object?
Not that it's not reasonable for them to object, but Carnegie and Apatow already made the point. It can be reasonable for you to do something and you don't get paid because, as it turned out, it didn't help. It didn't help either because, in this case, Carnegie and Apatow already made the point.
But by not letting anyone else know that he intended to revisit the revision issue, didn't Judge Zagel place the appellants in a position where they had to expend resources to object to the reversion provision in order to protect their clients? In other words, he gave preliminary appeal to the settlement, but his statements indicate that he was not, in fact, approving the reversion provision, but he was going to see how the claims proceeded and decide that letter. So why should the court's unspoken intent that was contrary to the preliminary approval defeat their entitlement to fees?
Well, I don't think that alone does it, because I think Judge Zagel also made the point that Carnegie and Apatow, the other interveners, had already made the point. So So if you're making a duplicate of objection, you assume some risk. The judge
Carnegie and whoever.
Those were the.
Yeah, I know, but they didn't ask for.
No, they did, but they were the ones who had brought the. You know, if it's the first in time, first objector to raise a point, is the causative factor. Here, the judge found there was no objector with the causative factor. If the rule is going to be first person to point something out, the judge eventually does gets paid, then it would have been these guys. You know, I think it would
be... But no one else was objecting to the level of fees.
Oh, the level of fees is just Martinez. Right, that's a separate issue.
Right.
But Martinez didn't object to the level of fees either. What Martinez said is, don't decide the fee application now. Wait and see how much the class actually gets, and base the fee award on what the class actually gets, which the judge did. That was fine. That didn't benefit the class. It didn't hurt us. So it was a good procedural suggestion, but it didn't confer any benefit on the class. I don't even know if it was calculated. Maybe it would have, maybe possibly, but it didn't. But getting back to justifying our fee award, I think I've explained that this was not a sure thing. That we were facing a lot of risks at the beginning, and that it took a lot of work to get where we are, and that that the moment the Metropolitan Club should not be treated as ground zero, that there was a lot that had gone on before then, and there was a lot that has to go on afterwards, and that it was a team effort that involved Miller Forche and Howard and Francine in order to get what we got, and it was a difficult thing to get. It was better than anybody had ever gotten before on cases that had been promising but losers.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you to... No. Time expired. Okay. I think that'll do it. Pardon?
No.
Okay, so thank you very much to all the counsel, and of course the case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.